Welcome, everybody. My name is Mark Schwain, and I'm here in the village for a couple of weeks now on teaching staff and helping my wife, Dorothy Bass, who's the summer teaching staff coordinator, coordinate the summer teaching staff while she's serving on the Holden board over the next few days. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach at Valparaiso Universities and taught there for years in the Honors College. Basically taught humanities there and sometimes taught Norman McLean in the course of my studies and my courses. And this session is on the life and work of Norman McLean. Next week I'll do two. One will be kind of a reprise of this session, and then I'll have a whole session on his last and posthumously published book, Young Men in Fire. Let me get some idea just a little bit of you folks here. How many of you have just never read Norman McLean at all and want to get to know him for the first time by coming here? Okay, so about half are really just going to come and learn what you can about this man and his work and see if it's the kind of thing that you might want to look at. And I'm guessing the other half has read at least some of his work. So I'll pitch the presentation basically to those who know nothing about Norman and are just here to learn something about him and try to give you enough, those of you who haven't read Norman's work, enough samplings of his writing and his voice, hopefully to tempt you to get some of his work. Begin with a personal story, which tells you a little bit about the slant of my interest. In 1975, I had recently finished my doctoral work and got my first teaching job at the University of Chicago. A rather daunting first appointment, particularly since I was appointed there in the Humanities Collegiate Division to teach Common Core courses, that is, courses that were required of first-year students, but that were not located within a particular academic discipline, just teaching students to read closely. The first quarter's reading list, which I will never forget, began with the first five chapters of Gibbon's Decline and Fall, went on to King Lear, went on to the Odyssey, and went on to a particular essay by Hume on the inquiries into morals. And I had read none of these books, much less taught them. So it was doubly daunting to kind of go into a situation like that at a university like the U of C, trained as an American intellectual historian, having to teach books that I'd not, as I say, studied closely. So I had a busy summer. And on the first day of that summer, I was unpacking in Gates Blake Hall, which is where my office was. It looks on one of the central quads at Chicago. It's right across, if you've been there, from Swift Hall, which is a divinity school. And I looked out the window as I was unpacking, and here was a guy dressed pretty much like I am now, wearing a fedora, not one of these type of caps, and he had a trowel and was tending to one of the trees in the quad there, and I assumed that he surely is the gardener. Don't pay much attention to him. And then Richard Stryer, who was a regular faculty member, I was appointed first as a postdoctoral teaching fellow, comes by for lunch. And we walk over to the quad club to have lunch by this gentleman who's tending to the tree. And Stryer says to me, "You know who that is?" I said, "I assume he's the gardener." "No, that's Norman McLean. Norman McLean taught here really since 1928, just retired 1973. And he said, "The big rumor here is that he's finished finally this magnificent collection of three stories, and that the U of C Press is breaking all of its precedents never to publish fiction, and it'll be out in 1976, but he's done, the manuscript is in, and people are murmuring about it." And he says, "What's more, it's about fly fishing." Well, this piqued my interest. I'd heard of Norman McLean and his important role in the whole area of the critical school that grew out of the University of Chicago, but and I love fly fishing. And so I just kind of took note of him and moved on, and we had lunch. Well, as fate would have it, over the course of my time in Chicago, which was 8 years, I did get to know him some. Better, I got to know his son-in-law, Joel Snyder, who was married to Norman's daughter, Jean, and a circle of young faculty who had studied with Norman. So it was really this kind of circle of people I grew to know who spent a lot of time telling Norman stories. And once in a while, I was invited over to spend some time with him, so in groups. So I did get to know him a little bit. But that sort of was the seed of my interest in his work, which I read then dutifully and happily when River Runs Through It and other stories came out in 1976. So that was the sort of source of my interest in him, and found that we shared not only a love of literature, but a love of fly fishing, and off I went. In the time that we have, what I'd like to do is to talk a little bit about his life, and then give you some samples of the River Runs Through It work. First in his own voice, because I have something here which has him reading from it, and then of the conclusion of the film that he finally permitted Robert Redford to make in 1990. It was released a couple years later, River Runs Through It. And we'll kind of be hearing excerpts then in Norman's voice from the beginning, and then in Redford's voice over the end of River Runs Through It. And then I want to expand on some of those texts and want to some basically then talk about more deeply what he was up to in his works, if there's time. Feel free to interrupt with questions anytime you'd like. So what about Norman then? Norman was born in 1902, December 23rd, in a tiny little town, a little speck on the map in southwestern Iowa called Clarinda, which is about 5 miles north of the Missouri border and about 20 miles east of the Nebraska border. But by the time he was 6 years old, 1908, he moved to Missoula, Montana, where his father became the minister of the First Presbyterian Church there in Missoula, and where he served for many years in that capacity. Norman did not attend school until he was 11 years old, which would have been 1913, because he was educated at home by his father, who taught him in the following way. They would have lessons in the morning in math and reading mostly, and then he had the afternoon to wander the whole great Montana countryside. By day he learned to read books, by afternoon he learned to read the woods. And this was to have a lasting mark upon everything he did, because he was one of those rare people who was as good as reading the book of nature as he was in reading the book of culture, and saw the two of them together. And indeed, in his early years, he brought the two of them together. He fell in love, thanks to his father, with the poet Wordsworth, in his judgment always the great nature poet, and he would always take Wordsworth with him and read Wordsworth's poetry on these excursions into the woods, so that when he wasn't learning to read the woods and learning to be a fly fisherman, he was reading Wordsworth, which had an enduring mark upon everything he did. Just a section of Wordsworth's Prelude, his great epic, which talks about the unfolding of his own life, and the first part is on the development of Wordsworth's own poetic imagination. And this will be important later when you hear Norman talk about the river. This is Wordsworth now. "Was it for this that won the fairest of all rivers? Love to blend his murmurs with my nurse's song. And from the alder shades and rocky falls, and from his fords and shallows, sent a voice that flowed along my dreams. For this didst thou, O Derwent," it's the name of the river, "winding among grassy helms when I was looking on, a babe in arms, make ceaseless music that composed my thoughts to more than infant softness, giving amid the fretful dwellings of mankind, a foretaste, a dim earnest of the calm that nature breathes among the hills and groves." So if you get this image in Wordsworth already of the murmurs and the sounds of the river blending with the voice of the nurse and shaping the poet's mind. And you couldn't find, in a way, a better description of the fabric of Norman's own experience, nature sort of shaping his poetic imagination very early as he's growing up there in the Montana wilderness. Well, in 1921 then, when he's 18, he goes off to school where he studies at Dartmouth for 4 years, always coming back in the summers to work in the United States Forest Service. Because at age 15, which would have been the year 1917, before going off to Dartmouth, he joins the United States Forest Service. If you know 1917, April 2nd, when we declare war, enter World War I, and that basically emptied a lot of the logging camps and a lot of the folks from the Forest Service, which had just really been founded in 1905. And so Norman, lying about his age at 15, joins the United States Forest Service and spends pretty much every summer until, his mid or late 20s, fighting forest fires, clearing trails, and doing other things for the Forest Service. So every summer at Dartmouth, he comes back. So he has this movement from east to west kind of built into his life, which was to remain a kind of movement for the rest of his life, because he would always spend, once he gets the appointment in 1928 at University of Chicago, the academic year there, and a long, long summer back at his cabin in Seeley Lake, which he starts to build with his father already in 1921, the first summer after his first year at Dartmouth. At Dartmouth, he studies with, among other people, Robert Frost, and comes to admire very much the spare economy that Frost's poetry evinces. Simple, monosyllabic words, deceptively simple in the sense that the poems themselves are extremely complex. And Frost was to remain his whole life one of the influences, certainly not as great as Wordsworth, on Norman's work. 1928, as I've said, he gets his first appointment as a teaching assistant. He's actually done that a couple of years at Dartmouth after he's graduated at the University of Chicago. He doesn't get his PhD till 1940, so he does a lot of years, 12, of teaching composition and other yeoman-like courses in literature as he's working on his own PhD. But he wins the Outstanding Teaching Award at the University of Chicago twice before he even gets his PhD, and twice more after that, the only professor ever to teach at U of C who won the Quantrell four times. So he was an outstanding teacher, literary critic, scholar, but as yet had really written nothing except for critical essays when he retired in 1973. So here's a man who's 70 years old, who's not written a single work, not a single word of fiction, only two critical essays, one on 18th century lyric poetry, a second one, which of course Wordsworth, late 18th, early 19th century, that was one subject, and the other a great essay on Shakespeare's King Lear. He would never get tenure today at the U of C. It would just be inconceivable. And it wouldn't matter whether he'd won 10 Quantrell Awards. Lots of Quantrell Award readers, winners don't get tenure at the U of C. But fortunately, he came of age in which two essays were fine. He was an outstanding teacher, and that's where he spent his entire teaching career. So 1973 comes along, he retires at age 70, and his children urge him to write some of these stories that he has always told them, and he gets to work. And we see the first fruits of this, as I said, in 1976, when U of C brings out this book. So that's kind of a skeletal picture of his life. You could say, and I'll come back to this at the end if there's time, the three major influences on his life in terms of books, the major influence was his father, but in terms of books would have been Wordsworth's nature poetry, Shakespearean tragedy, and of course the Bible, his father being a minister, and reading to him all the time to the rest of the family from the Bible. And we'll notice some of those accents later. So what kind of a guy was Norman? Let me talk a little bit about his character. He was the kind of guy you would expect to come out of basically logging camps, the U.S. Forest Service in its infancy, and who spent the happiest moments of his youth in this kind of hard, tough work among a lot of hard, tough men. He was therefore, in his writing and in his speech, as they said in Montana, often profane but never vulgar. And so you pick up in his works some of that intonation from time to time. But he also was tough in terms of physically tough. He was 165 pounds, 5'8" tall, built kind of like a halfback in his era. Not a bit of body fat, as you might imagine. Always, as his students said, kind of like a coiled spring, tense, ready to explode into verbiage, while his brother Paul exploded in different ways. But the two were tough guys, and that meant that Norman did not suffer fools gladly, and that he could bear grudges for some time, and you'd better not cross him the wrong way at the wrong time. A letter came to light, just to give you a sample of his tendency to hold a grudge, after he died. And it was a letter that he wrote to Alfred A. Knopf, one of the most elite, some would say the snootiest, publisher on the East Coast. Background to this is several East Coast publishers had rejected the manuscript River Runs Through It. In fact, he couldn't get it published in the East. The East was, one of them sent back a letter saying this novel has trees in it, which made it, of course, appropriate that I first see him tending a tree. And he never got over the fact that he was repeatedly rejected by them, and especially by Knopf. And because Knopf is the most selective of the Eastern presses. And lo and behold, after River Runs Through It becomes kind of internationally famous, and he gets around now to seeing if anybody's going to be interested in publishing Young Men in Fire, his second, and he only wrote two major books. And word got out that he was working on that book, and he gets a letter from Knopf wondering if they might publish it and have a look at it. Norman doesn't remember when they've asked about his earlier rejections, but then comes to remember this later, and he writes them the following letter. This gives you kind of a flavor of what I'm talking about. Harper's published the letter, and they titled the letter, this wasn't Norman's, "A Grudge Runs Through It." "Dear Mr. Elliott, I've discovered that I've been writing to you under false pretenses, although stealing from myself more than from you. I have stolen from myself the opportunity of seeing the dream of every rejected author come true. The dream of every rejected author must be to see, like sugar plums dancing in his head, 'Please, can't we see your next manuscript letters,' standing in piles on his desk, all coming from publishing companies that rejected his previous manuscript, especially from the more pompous of the fatted cows grazing contentedly in the publishing field. I'm sure that, under the influence of those dreams, some of the finest screw-you prose in the English language has been composed, but alas, never published. And to think that the rare moment in history came to me when I could in actuality have written the prose masterpiece for all rejected authors, and I didn't even see that history had swung wide open its doors for me. You must have known that Alfred A. Knopf turned down my first collection of stories, playing games with it, or at least the game of cat's paw, now rolling it over and saying they were going to publish it, and then rolling it on its back when the president of the company announced it wouldn't sell. So I can't understand how you could ask if I'd submit my second manuscript to Alfred A. Knopf unless you don't know my race of people. And I can't understand how it didn't register on me, Alfred A. Knopf is clear enough on your stationery. But although I let the big moment elude me, it has given rise to little pleasures. For instance, whenever I receive a statement of the sales of A River Runs Through It from the University of Chicago Press, I see that someone at the press has written across the bottom of it, hurrah for Alfred A. Knopf. However, having let the great moment slip by unrecognized and unadorned, I can only now weakly say this. If the situation ever arose when Alfred A. Knopf was the only publishing house remaining in the world, and I was the sole surviving author, that would mark the end of the world of books. So he did compose the great masterpiece of that genre, after all. But that last line in an interview, which I'm about to read you from, to try to get at what was underneath his toughness, he cites that line as one of the best he'd ever written, that particular sentence. He quoted verbatim to the interviewer. And so now I'm going to read you a little bit about where this kind of toughness comes from. And first I'm going to read from an interview, and then I'm going to read from a section of River Runs Through It, where he talks about the same thing, and you'll catch the different intonation. So what lies underneath this toughness? He says in this interview, the title story of River Runs Through It was the big tragedy of our family, my brother's character and his death. We had a very loving family, but we were independent and fighters. We were guys who, since the world was hostile to us, depended heavily upon the support and the love of our family. That tends often to be the case with guys that live a hostile life outside the family. There was our family, which meant so much to us, and there was my brother, who was a street fighter, a tough guy who lived outside the mores of a preacher's family. We all loved him and stood by him, but we couldn't help him. But we tried, but we couldn't. There were times when we didn't know whether he needed help. That was all, and he was killed. I slowly came to feel that it would never end unless I wrote it. So there you get a kind of a sense already of the plot of River Runs Through It, and you also get a sense of what his agenda is, to try to finally get over this by writing about it. So now here is the same kind of point that he just made in the interview, made much earlier in a River Runs Through It on page 9. And this, I think, gets even closer to capturing MacLean's personal character. He says, undoubtedly the difference between my brother and I would not have seemed so great if we had not been such a close family. Painted on one side of our Sunday school wall were the words, God is love. We always assumed that these three words were spoken directly to the four of us, that is the father, the mother, and the two brothers in our family, and had no reference to the world outside, which my brother and I soon discovered was full of bastards, the number increasing rapidly the further one gets from Missoula, Montana. We also held in common the knowledge that we were tough. This knowledge increased with age, at least until we were well into our 20s and probably longer, possibly much longer. But our differences showed even in our toughness. I was tough by being a product of tough establishments, the United States Forest Service and the logging camps. Paul was tough by thinking that he was tougher than any establishment. My mother and I watched horrified morning after morning while the Scottish minister tried to make his small child eat oatmeal. My father was also horrified, at first because a child of his own bowels would not eat God's oats, and as the days went by, because his wee child proved tougher than he was. As the minister raged, the child bowed his head over the food and folded his hands as if his father were saying grace. The child gave only one sign of his own great anger. His lips became swollen. The hotter my father got, the colder the porridge, until finally my father burned out. So in some sense, you could talk about River Runs Through It as about two brothers who were tough in these different ways. But in this passage from River Runs Through It, you see that on the one side there's a kind of toughness, and on the other side, kind of tenderness. And McLean, it seems to me, is one of those people who whose toughness and whose tenderness, whose tough-mindedness and tender-mindedness, was a kind of inner conflict. Not a kind of sentimental tough guy with the heart of gold kind of image that you get, say, in Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca, where you know that Humphrey Bogart's toughness is just a kind of exterior and inside he's going to melt when Ingrid Bergman melts. But Norman really had a genuinely tough side, which you saw in that Grudge Runs Through It, and a genuinely tender side, and they produced a kind of wonderful tension that ran through more than just Rivers, but through his works. Let's hear then a little bit. I think you get a sense of a person's character from their voice. So let's listen to Norman reading the opening of A River Runs Through It.
In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. We lived at the junction of great trout rivers in western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. He told us about Christ's disciples being fishermen, and we were left to assume, as my brother and I did, that all first-class fishermen on the Sea of Galilee were fly fishermen, and that John the favorite was a dry fly fisherman. I write by paragraphs. Yeah, a paragraph is very important to me as a unit of, as a unit in the narration, as a sound unit too. I have a feeling that it ought to be like a little blot. It's starting and gets kind of complicated as in the middle, and then it kind of resolves itself at the end. Although only partly resolves itself at the end, because it also should be throwing itself ahead for the next paragraph. The paragraphs are very, everybody has, I suppose, a different unit that he works by. But paragraphs are about as close as to my favorite as any of them. It is true that one day a week was given over wholly to religion. On Sunday mornings, my brother, Paul, and I went to Sunday school, and then to morning services to hear our father preach. And in the evenings, the Christian Endeavor, and afterwards, the evening services to hear our father preach again. In between, on Sunday afternoons, we had to study the Westminster Shorter Catechism for an hour, and then recite before we could walk the hills with him, and while he unwound between services. But he never asked us more than the first question in the catechism: what is the chief end of man? And we answered together so one of us could carry on if the other forgot. Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. That's a wonderful sentence, isn't it? Comes from John, I think, the Gospel of John. This always seemed to satisfy him, as indeed such a beautiful answer should have. And besides, he was anxious to be on the hills where he could restore his soul and be filled again to overflowing with the evening sermon. His chief way of recharging himself was to recite to us from the sermon that was coming, enriched here and there with selections from the most successful passages of his morning sermon. Even so, in a typical week of our childhood, Paul and I probably received as many hours of instruction in fly fishing as we did in all other spiritual matters. After my brother and I became good fishermen, we realized that our father was not a great fly caster, but he was accurate and stylish, and wore a glove on his casting hand. As he buttoned his glove in preparation to give us a lesson, he would say, "It is an art that is performed on a four-count rhythm between 10 and 2 o'clock." As a Scot and Presbyterian, my father believed that man by nature was a mess and had fallen from an original state of grace. Somehow I early developed the notion that he had done this by falling from a tree. As for my father, I never knew whether he believed God was a mathematician, but he certainly believed God could count, and that only by picking up God's rhythms were we able to regain power and beauty. Unlike many Presbyterians, he often used the word beautiful.
Okay, so have a sense of what this man sounded like. And you have a sense, the more you read him, that all of what he's up to and all of his works is contained in those few paragraphs. Most importantly, the point at the end about grace and nature and God's rhythms, which I'll return to if there's time at the end, that is this whole question about whether there, the patterns, and one simply has to bring them out, or whether one makes them and constructs them and imposes them on the world. So that whole business of picking up God's rhythms as a way to regain power and grace is crucial to almost everything that Norman will do. So I thought now we'd look at the end, and I did not make enough copies. I'm just kind of like everybody here. So if you'd share, I'm going to pass out. This is the last paragraph of River Runs Through It. And what's going to happen here is I'm going to show you material from the film. And we're going to pick up the film at a point where this is the very end of, you'll hear Redford's voiceover. Providing the voice of the narrator, and he's just gotten the call announcing that Paul has been killed. And you'll see him going to the police station and then trying to process with his father who Paul was and what the meaning of Paul's death may have been. And then you'll see the closing scene where Robert Redford, the narrator, will read this great last paragraph of A River Runs Through It.
So when the police sergeant awakened me one morning, just before Jesse and I left for Chicago, I rose and asked him questions. Drove me back home down the length of the river so that I could tell my father and mother that Paul had been beaten to death by the butt of a revolver and his body dumped in an alley. You can tell me.
Nearly all the bones in his hand were broken.
Which hand? As time passed, my father struggled for more to hold on to, asking me again and again, had I told him everything? And finally, I said to him, maybe all I really know about Paul is that he was a fine fisherman. You know more than that, my father said. He was beautiful. And that was the last time we ever spoke of my brother's death. Indirectly, though, Paul was always present in my father's thoughts. I remember the last sermon I heard him give, not long before his own death.
Each one of us here today will, at one time in our lives, look upon a loved one who is in need and ask the same question. We are willing to help, Lord, but what, if anything, is needed? For it is true we can seldom help those closest to us. Either we don't know what part of ourselves to give, or more often than not, the part we have to give is not wanted. And so it is those we live with and should know who elude us. But we can still love them. We can love completely without complete understanding.
Thank you.
Now nearly all those I loved and did not understand in my youth are dead, even Jesse. But I still reach out to them. Of course, now I am too old to be much of a fisherman. And now I usually fish the big waters alone, although some friends think I shouldn't. But when I am alone in the half-light of the canyon, all existence seems to fade to a being with my soul and memories, and the sounds of the Big Blackfoot River and a four-count rhythm, and the hope that a fish will rise. Eventually, all things merge into one, and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words. And some of the words are theirs. I am haunted by waters.
Okay, so I thought we might talk further about Norman's work by talking about just this closing paragraph that we just heard read there by Redford. Redford was able to make this movie only because Norman took a personal liking to him and came to trust him. Many directors had approached Norman and screenwriters wanting to do this book, and he had rejected all of them. But as he got to know Redford and something about Redford's own life, he came to give him permission to go ahead and make this film. Most of the screenplays that he looked at that others had tried before Redford found somebody to do the screenwriting for this one had tried to prettify the book. That, by that I mean to say, had tried to sentimentalize the death of Paul. And Norman always thought of this as a modern tragedy, having to do with what you heard his father proclaim there, that those that we most love and live with are often those who elude us, and how we can't often help those, no matter how hard we try. So in some ways, it's a tragedy of helplessness. That's a little bit different from, I was thinking of this because I just happened to be looking at Elaine Pagel's book, Adam, Eve, and the Serpent. And Elaine Pagel wrote that book, which is about Genesis, just after her husband had died in a tragic climbing accident. And she takes up at the end of that book this great argument between St. Augustine and his great opponent in the last years of his life, Julian of Aquanum. And to make a long story short, they argued about human agency, free will, divine providence, and so forth. And Elaine Pagel finally comes down on the side of Julian and argues that finally in human life we would rather feel guilty than helpless. She says this, we would rather feel guilty than helpless. To feel guilty gives you a sense that you at least have some agency. You are responsible for something and you failed and now you feel guilty. To be helpless is to deny agency or to deny the fact that there's anything you can do. And there's something, she argued in that book, more frightening and in a sense deeply tragic about owning up to helplessness than owning up to guilt. And I thought of that when I, just now actually, when I heard him for about the 25th time preach that sermon, because that's partly the character of this tragedy, that they just can't help Paul. And one great, I think, context in which to assign this book is all people who are in helping professions, because it really does make you think hard about what giving help is and about the relationship between the person who's offering the help and the person who needs it, et cetera, et cetera. It's very profound on that. The book works on many levels. Fly fishermen like me love it because you can read it simply as a fly fishing manual. Norman always thought his favorite summary of the book was given by a teenager at some community college where he was visiting, and she was asked to provide a plot summary, and she said, they go fishing again, they get drunk, they go fishing a third time. And he said, absolutely, that sums up the plot, and in a way, it does. Of course, fly fishermen know you can actually learn to fly fish. Each stage of this book, you learn different steps. There's a whole long section on casting, and then you go on. Each time they go fishing, you learn more about how to match the aquatic animals to flies, etc., how to read rivers. And so fly fishermen reviewing this for all the leading fly fishing manuals said that this is a perfect book on to learning how to fly fish. So there's, in everything Norman writes, these multiple levels. But to look at the passage, if you have it in front of you, I just want to draw out a few things. We can talk by just starting about noticing the rhythm of these words. Because remember, we talked at the beginning of the book about picking up God's rhythms in how we cast flies. Well, another sort of rhythm we pick up that Norman thought were God's rhythms we install in language or poetry. And Norman's prose is a kind of poetry. I mean, you don't have to be able to scan poetry to see a sentence like, the river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. And you can just feel that rhythm. Even if your ear isn't trained, that kind of language subliminally has a kind of effect upon you. Let me just read you Norman talking about this matter of the rhythms of his prose here in the same interview from which I quoted earlier. He says, now when I teach poetry or prose, I can teach it quite analytically. When I was at Stanford, I had a long session analyzing prose rhythms with their advanced creative writing class. That's not easy to do, partly because the rule of prose rhythms is that you'd better not have them show very much. And most of the time, you better not have them show off at all. Anytime you or I or anybody else who has any taste at all suspects that the writer's trying to write pretty, and when they suspect that, the writer is dead. That guy is just as dead as a dead snake. If you are a writer whose prose falls into rhythms, you have to be very, very careful. Most of the time, you just approach rhythms and then drift away from them, and then drift back towards them, not really going into any rhythmical passages except as the tension mounts, as the passion increases. If you look at the last page of A River Runs Through It, you can scan it as if it were written in accentual rhythm. But when you're on the sandbar earlier in the novel, with that whore and that goddamn brother-in-law of mine, you don't hear any rhythms, although they're there. They're very faint. They come close to rhythm and then drift out. My ordinary style is better than ordinary speech, but not so much that you would really notice it. Then he talks about when he uses certain cadences, it depends on the kind of emotional level you're operating on. A River Runs Through It is my notion of high modern tragedy. It's tragedy and deep feeling, and I tried to write about how men and women do things with great skill and loving kindness, with their hands and their hearts, both at the same time. Fishing is such an example, but rhythm is there even when I stop and tell you how you put hobnails in a shoe, and why you put them where you put them, and how you pack a horse. I like to tell you about things that men and women can do with their hands and that are wonderful. I write about them very carefully all the time. I'm on a level above ordinary speech because what I'm trying to tell you is above ordinary speech. I'm trying to tell you how you do things expertly. When I do that, the language goes up a little bit. And certainly, when you come to the great tragic moments, when you're just pouring your heart out, you don't have to worry about your rhythms. They'll be there if you're at all a rhythmic person. So there you get him talking about the kind of rhythms in that great passage and throughout the book, really. And I could just give you one sentence. Now, this whole business that you see in the paragraph about some of the words are theirs and the words are under the rocks. This has been prepared for in a conversation that Norman has on the bank as they're watching Paul fishing for the last time, because his father has gone with them. His father's on the bank reading, and what his father is reading, you will learn. So he comes up, Norman, sits next to his father. Paul is still fishing. So, what have you been reading? A book, my father said. It was on the ground on the other side of him, so I would not have to bother to look over his knees to see it, he said. A good book. Then he told me, quote, in the part I was reading, it says the word was in the beginning. And that's right. I used to think water was first, but if you listen carefully, you will hear that the words are underneath the water. Quote, that's because you're a preacher first and then a fisherman, I told him. If you ask Paul, he will tell you that the words are formed out of the water. Nope, my father said, you are not listening carefully. The water runs over the words. Paul will tell you the same thing. Where is Paul anyway? So when he says you're not listening carefully, it's not clear whether you're not listening to me carefully, you're not listening to the word carefully, or you're not listening to the river carefully. He works on all three of those things. So in that little phrase, you're not listening carefully, you see kind of a merger there of the words of Scripture that the father is quoting, the words the father himself is speaking to Norman, and the sounds of the great river. And think back now to what I read you at the very beginning of Wordsworth, poet, being formed by the Derwent as his nurse was walking him, and he was listening to what he called the voice of the river. And you sort of see this kind of Gospel of John and Wordsworth, and they're coming together in this river. And he even says here that he glances at the book, I'm not going to read the whole passage, and he sees in his father's Greek New Testament the word logos in the beginning was the word. Norman, in other words, had prepared for this last paragraph throughout the whole book by setting up conversations like that one. Even the reference to the great flood, which is in that passage, when we hear that read, we automatically think, as he wants us to think, of the great flood in the Bible. And it has that resonance. But already, at the beginning of River Runs Through It, on pages, I don't want to run over time here, 14 and 15, he sort of sets this up, and I was going to read the passage, but I won't read the whole passage, by talking about the great flood, the greatest one that has been kind of recorded by geologists, that takes place in that very spot in Montana and carves up the great Blackfoot River, which he fished, and for which the evidence of the scope and dimensions of the flood was never available until you had satellite technology and you could photograph the whole area. So when he's talking about the world's great flood, in the context of the book, he means that flood. But he means it to have this larger resonance. And on the other hand, of course, it's the very place that he stood, right in that canyon that was formed by that very great flood. So what Norman always does in his writing is to believe that the harder you are faithful to the actual facts, and the greater trouble you take with the actual facts, the more astonished you are at not just nature, but at something that sort of, what I would call what you get in the Gospel of John, that behind nature, there's something even more extraordinary. But the way you get to that is not by being sentimental or going mystical too quickly, but by looking very hard at the actual facts themselves. Another example of that. Of course, what figures in this last paragraph once more is the hope that a trout will rise. And so you talk about the trout and the importance of trout fishing and the importance of these particular fish. And I'm going to read you now a passage that comes in this very special edition of River Runs Through It that U of C Press bought out in 1983, which has photographs by Norman's son-in-law, and which contains an essay, which is available nowhere else, about trout. And I'm going to read you a little passage of that, and I want you to notice how, in some ways, the more scientific you are about trout for Norman, the closer you come to something very much like you get in Wordsworth's poetry. So let me read you that passage. He's talking about trout now. Most important of all about these shallow, slow-moving waters with gravel bottoms is that they are the spawning grounds of the large family of fish to which the trout belong, the salmonids, the most famous member of which is the salmon itself. To them, the adventure to birth is much the same mystery as the adventure to death. Wordsworth, our great nature poet, speaks of our birth as our life star that, quote, hath had elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar. But even these lines of poetry seem less wondrous than the adventure to birth of the members of this family of fish, the salmon and the steelhead trout, the name for rainbow trout that have left fresh waters and gone to sea. When I was 15, and this would have been when he joined the Forest Service in the year 1917, I had asked questions as a boy might ask who wasn't yet sure of how to find his way in the woods. Quote, how do salmon and steelhead trout and some cutthroat trout ever find their way back from Japan through 3,500 miles of northern seas? And, quote, how do they ever know the river and its headwaters where they were born? These fish that come from afar. There are now fish biologists with answers to these questions. And in some ways, the answers seem so obvious as to be inevitable, but in the long run, they only leave the mysterious more incredible. The answer to the first question is, they steer through the seas by the solar system. Now remember the Daystar. At first, one asks oneself, how else? But wonder still remains when one realizes the fish is steering essentially a straight course by following a moving body, and so must have some allocation of atoms in his brain, which is no bigger than a pea, allowing him to compensate for the movement of the sun across the sky as he sees it. He has to make an even more remarkable compensation because the rays of the sun, when they strike the water, are refracted, so that the sun appears to be in a different position from the one it appears to be to any beholder outside the water. It is even harder to believe that the answer, it is even harder to believe the answer to the second question is also inside that pea brain. The answer to the second question is, he recognizes the mouth of his own river by its smell, and he smells the way upriver to the place that he was born. I'm sure that in the vast empty spaces in my skull, where my brain is supposed to be, there is no pea with a mystery in it that can, quote, and this is from a scientific book now, quote, detect dissolved substances in concentrations as low as one part in 3 quinquadrillion. That has a 3 with 18 zeros behind it, okay? So the concentration of this molecule that the trout can smell is in that concentration after this trout has steered 3,500 miles by star. And Norman was unbelievable both in this book and in Young Man Fire in sort of spending years getting the science straight, because he believed all he had to do was to get the science straight and you'd be convinced that there's more to this than meets the eye. So let me read one more passage. I think one more, yeah, then we'll go. Because I'm going to give you a little foretaste of Young Men in Fire. And this will give you a sort of sense of, when you read Norman, of the multiple relationships between science, theology, art, well, all of these different dimensions, words, nature, etc. This is a true story, and it's going to be a short one. And he tells it first in a great essay he wrote, and then he tells it in this book, and it'll explain to you why he, in a way, was, I think, born to write this book. You had to be able to read the woods as well as you read literature, and you had to be old, and you had to be, this book is the mourning for his wife, in the same way that this was mourning for his brother. So, in a way, he was born to write this book. But he's gonna talk now about the kind of thing that led him to found at the University of Chicago, the program I actually taught in called the Committee on General Studies, because he believed that if you're gonna understand what matters, you have to be able to understand it from multiple views. So here's this story and then we'll close. When I was a young teacher and thought of myself as a billiards player, I had the pleasure of watching Albert Abraham Michelson play billiards every noon. He was by then one of our national idols, having been the first American to win the Nobel Prize in science for the measurement of the speed of light, among other things. To me, he took on added luster because he was the best amateur billiards player I had ever seen. One noon, while he was still shaking his head at himself for missing an easy shot, after he had a run of 35 or 36, I said to him, "You're a fine billiards player, Mr. Michelson." He shook his head at himself and said, "Nope, I'm getting old. I can still make the long three cushion shots, but I'm losing the soft touch on the short ones." He chalked up, but instead of taking the next shot, he finished what he had to say. Billiards, though, is a good game. But billiards is not as good a game as chess. Still chalking his cue, he said, "Chess, though, is not as good a game as painting." And then he made it final by saying, "But painting is not as good a game as physics." Then he hung up his cue and went home to spend that afternoon painting under the large tree on his front lawn. So that's a true story, and it sort of captures this sense in which if you really are going to begin to plumb what matters, you have to be able to do what I think Norman MacLean, among very few writers, was able to do, which is to operate on all these different dimensions simultaneously. Thank you.